there last time. What I did last time was to give you more or less a kind of an introduction to what is integral yoga. But today, as I promised, I'll take you a little deeper into what exactly are we supposed to do in the integral yoga. Although there is no specific path, as we said, that you have to do this or that, yet we should be clear regarding some notions. Because we use the word like, say, surrender and aspiration and prayer and grace and the divine. I'd like to look into that a little deeper today. And you have called my talk for today the 5 principles of integral yoga. And as you wrote to me, this is what you saw in George's book. But you see, each one of us can really look into it as we want. Some people say there are 4 principles, 5 principles. Some may say there are only 3 principles, aspiration, rejection, surrender. So what is important is not the number of principles. And yet, we must know some of the basic steps, which are really given in this book. The mother. And this integral yoga is better called as the sunlit path. And when we say integral yoga, like we have seen last time, we have to explain many other things. But the mother and Sri Aurobindo towards the end called it the sunlit path. And in that sunlit path, or on that sunlit path, what are the things that you require to do? What are the steps you need to take? Well, the very first sentence of this book, I think almost gives us a whole summary of the sunlit path, one single sentence. There are 2 powers that alone can affect in their conjunction the great and difficult thing which is the aim of our endeavor. A fixed and unfailing aspiration that calls from below and a supreme grace from above that answers. So this is the essence of the sunlit path, the call from below and the grace from above. But Sri Aurobindo continues here and tells us what are the steps between the call and the grace. Because it is very interesting. What do we mean by the call? Does the grace come on its own? And he would say here in this book that the grace also has its own conditions. So there are quite many things between these two, although we think it is simply the call and the grace. To connect these two, there are other steps which we need to take on the sunlit path. So today what I am going to deal with are basically these 4 steps. One is the call. How do we start? What is the meaning of the call? Then once we have the call, is it sufficient? No, it isn't. There must be the personal effort. And once there is a personal effort, then comes the grace. And in the last section I would give a little more. Grace from whom? He says grace from above. What is that above? Whose grace is it that we are expecting? Whose grace is it that comes down? Especially on the sunlit path. Otherwise in other religions we have been told grace of God. But is it the grace of God that we are seeking? If so, why and why not? And what is that God whose grace we want? So these are the things that we will discuss in the last section. So basically I call these principles as the call, the effort, the grace and the supramental Mahashakti. Because the particular grace we need in this yoga is of the mother who is the supramental Mahashakti. There could be grace of any other guru, any other god, any other divine. But we are not aiming at a general grace, we are aiming at a very particularized grace. And I think I told you on the first day why this particularized grace. He is not trying to be sectarian, trying to be religious, trying to have a creed mentality. But there is a metaphysical and a physical meaning why we want the mother's grace. So these are the four steps, and having time permitting, I think I would try to give the first two in the morning session, the second two in the afternoon session. Because the grace and the supramental Mahashakti will take us a little longer time. And of course, let us see after that what the grace tells us to do. Right? So this one I have a paper written, in fact. So I will read as I go along, I give further explanation. And this is really, I've gone very deep into the intricate details. It's no more just the terms as such. If by the term yoga, we have seen last time, we mean a methodized effort towards self-perfection by the expression of the potentialities latent in the being, and a union of the individual with the universal and the transcendental existence, then all life cannot be taken as yoga. Is it take straight away what we said, all life is yoga? I'm saying it cannot be all life is yoga in this particular sense. What is it? Yoga, we said last time, is union. But on the practical level, it is a methodized effort towards self-perfection. And that too by the expression of the potentialities latent in the being. You see, this is where we should understand. It is easy to define yoga as union with the divine. But when I put it into practical terms, how do I go about it? Is it a mechanical meditation? Is it a bhakti? No. It is actually an effort towards self-perfection. That means whatever is my potentiality within me. If I'm a philosopher, you are a poet, you are a carpenter, you are a mechanic, you are an engineer. Whatever is our potential within us, we are trying to perfect that. This is very important in yoga, because there could be a misunderstanding. Yoga means this life and not this life. Then what happens to me? I am an ordinary person. It's nothing to do with ordinary or divine person. But where we are, what we are, we start perfecting that. Well, you may say in your Western society, that there's no problem with us. We try to do the work that we do as well as possible. as perfectly as possible. But it's not just a question of doing the work as perfectly as possible, which is a normal, which is almost a kind of a second nature in the Western world, I've seen, doing work on the material level. You do with a tremendous sense of perfection. It's already almost inbuilt in your system. But what has to be added to your natural skill is the second part, and a union of the individual with the universal. You see, this is where the second part is missing. I may do the work for the sake of my house, my society, my government, but we have to add this element of the union with the universal. That means that I am offering this perfection to a higher spirit, to a divine consciousness. So if you can club these two, then it becomes yoga. And this is what Sri Krishna had said in the Gita also. The true spiritual living must be based on swabhava. Swabhava means one's own nature. I cannot imitate you, and you cannot imitate her, and she cannot imitate him. Because it's not my nature. A rose cannot be a lily, or a lily cannot be a tulip. They're all wonderful in their own way. And just now as I was coming, in the green grass I saw the red little flowers. They look so marvelous. One little there, one there, one there. But you cannot compare it with a tulip. Because if the tulip is there, it cannot be as beautiful. But this fresh orange color in that luscious green was brilliant. So each in its own place is the brilliance. You see, each one of us fulfilling ourselves, and of course, that little flower is offering herself to itself to the divine. And yet it did not want any praise from anybody. It just there on the wayside, fulfilling its blossom. And thereby it gives so much of ananda to people around, including the ananda who was passing by. So, this is exactly what each one of our life is. Each one is a little lily or is a little red flower. Some are on the wayside, some are on the central stage, some are on the parliament seat. Seats are different. But if we can fulfill our own swabhava, our own nature, and offer it to the divine, then that is the world of harmony and beauty. So this is where yoga really means an effective way of self-perfecting. At the same time, parallelly, giving this effort to the divine and not to any oneself or to any other human being, be it your own spouse, be it your own children, be it your own parents and your teacher. Listen, no, I am directly connected to the divine. I offer myself to the divine. Yes, Sri Aurobindo uses the word in the Gita. I think your next study in the group, you should take up the essays on the Gita. It's really a very close book on how to go about in yoga. What it says is this question of, well, maybe I will go a bit too much on the diversion. I better not go into the Gita. Let me come back to what I'm saying. So you see, when we say all life is yoga, please remember, it is only when the conscious yoga in man becomes like the subconscious yoga in nature, outwardly conterminous with life itself, that we can say, in a more perfect and luminous sense, all life is yoga. Well, you have read that book, most of you here. I'm sure there you have made it clear that all life can be yoga when it becomes a conscious yoga. How is Sri Aurobindo linking up? One is the subconscious yoga of nature, which is coming right from the beginning of creation. And what we have to do is the conscious yoga. To be conscious of what I am doing, what I want to do, what I want to become. Otherwise, if you are living an ignorant life, you know, daily doing what you want, going around whatever you want to do, not thinking of the divine, not offering, then it is not yoga at all. So each activity that we do in our life, if it is done consciously and offered consciously, remember these two words, if you can link up this extra dimension to work, then karma work becomes karma yoga. Karma yoga means karma that unites you with the divine. Yoga is union. Otherwise, karma remains karma. Work remains work. And this is where our Indian philosophy comes in of the karmic law. Karmic law or the law of karma. You might have read in Sri Aurobindo, now that you know so much. You see, in India we believe that every action has its own consequences. Be it good or be it bad, will have its consequences, either in this life or in the life next. So in India it has been explained, take care how you act, because it is going to have its consequence. And people think, how can it be, to this life I am rich and, you know, no police can touch me, no minister can touch me, I am above law even if I kill 3 people. But consequence is not necessarily here. It could be following in the next life also. Once to the ashram, a person came running to the mother and said, "Mother, please save me. The police is after me." She said, "Why?" "Because the police suspect that I have murdered a person, but mother, frankly, I have not done it. So mother, please protect me." Mother said, "But in the last life you committed a murder." So you see, she said, "No. In your previous life you did commit a murder." So you see how the consequence of the previous life is chasing you now. Although you have not done a murder now, but the police is after you. They may catch him and put him behind bar and you may say, "Where is justice? Really, where is justice?" Justice is not a unidimensional thing. Nowadays people are going a little more into the psychology and all that. But justice with mother was not just this life justice. There was a lady in those early days who had become a tremendous nuisance in the ashram. I mean, you know, who used to have a very kind of a, what in Indian terminology we call a loose behavior. I mean, you know, going about with the sadhas, attracting them, you know, trying to vitalize them, trying to pull them in. This kind of, you know, vital consciousness. And people were really disturbed. So mother was, the case was reported to mother saying, "You see, she is spoiling the atmosphere here, mother, get rid of her." Mother kept quiet. First time, second time, third time, reports went on. The people said, "What is this? We are reporting so much to the mother, she is not replying." Then the mother said that, "I know her previous births and how much she has suffered. She had really undergone some kind of a this pressure and sorrow and suffering in the previous births. So this birth she is kind of relieving herself of that sorrow of the previous births. So if I ask her to get away from here, then that little scope of kind of cleansing herself will be gone. And then this sorrow and suffering of the previous birth she will have to carry to the next life." So she said, "I know that if I get rid of her, I'm not helping you or her, at least definitely not her." So mother, what do we do in this practical level? We said the best thing is, whenever she comes in front of you, avoid her. Consciously, avoid her, nothing. Don't talk to her, don't say hello, good morning, nothing. But that's the best I can advise, that I will not ask her to leave the ashram. So this is the kind of the justice of the divine, who sees the past and the future and the present. And in one case, in fact, once Madhav Pandit who asked the mother, "Mother, where is justice? In the ashram there are so many things happening. You know, there's no proper justice being given. Mother said, do you really want justice? If I truly give justice here, none of you will remain in the ashram. I mean, that is the broad, comprehensive consciousness. So justice is a kind of a compromise, all said and done. I think that I am the best man, morally I am best. But if the divine sees what is in me and what I have done in the before and future. So she says, in the divine justice, hardly if it is applicable, in this world it will be difficult. So it's more the compassion that comes. You know, if the compassion supersedes justice, sort of it, we will see a little more about compassion. How it tolerates. So, she said, you must have patience. Don't just strike off somebody saying, no, he's a bad boy, wrong lady, or bad girl. Nothing. Have tolerance. Because nobody is about justice. And you remember the famous story by the incident in Christ's own life. When that lady was being stoned and that harlot was being stoned, he says, who is clean here? Who is without sin? We have named somebody a harlot and then we are putting, throwing stone. But that kind of a impurity, a harlot is only an impurity. But isn't that impurity in all of us? It's there, we have hidden it and that lady has exposed herself. So the mother also says, be careful when you really brand anybody as good or bad. You look at yourself and see where you stand, what right you have. So, we have to be really careful when we see about this yoga. It is kind of a conscious movement. Yoga must include life and not exclude it. Does not mean that we are bound to accept life as it is with all its stumbling ignorance and misery and the obscure confusion of human will and reason and impulse and instinct which it expresses. Yoga takes a stand that it is only by a change of consciousness that the true basis of life can be discovered. From within outward is needed the rule. One must go deep and find the soul, the self, the divine reality within. Within all of us, only then can life become a true expression of what can be instead of a blind and always repeated confused blur of the inadequate and imperfect thing we are. Well, this was only to introduce a deeper concept of yoga. What we said the other day was more a superficial thing, but this is always the danger in quoting Sri Aurobindo, especially that sentence of all life is yoga. So I wanted a little more clarification. Because in India and in ashram also, if we really do not make this distinction, then we lose the path of yoga actually. Then, you know, all our weaknesses, everything we convert into yoga, but as she says here, it must be conscious offering to the divine and also a kind of an effort in self-perfection. Now, last time we remember when we were discussing about the ordinary life, we said it's a life that is based on the ego center. But here, Mother gives a beautiful further description of what this ordinary life is. Well, Mother has her own way, you know, remarkably beautiful, simple, straightforward descriptions. People are occupied with outward things, the distinctive feature of ordinary life. That means that the consciousness is turned, that the consciousness is turned towards external things. That is, all the things of life which one sees, knows, does, instead of being turned inwards in order to find the deeper truth, the Divine Presence. This is the first movement. You are busy with all that you do, with the people around you, the things you use, and then with life, sleeping, eating, talking, working a little, having a little fun also, and then beginning over again, sleeping, eating, etc., etc. And then it begins again. And then what this one has said, what that one has said, what one ought to do, the lesson one ought to learn, the exercise one ought to prepare, and then again whether one is keeping well, whether one is feeling fit, etc. That is what one usually thinks about. So the first movement, and it is not so easy, is to make all that pass to the background and let one thing come inside and in front of the consciousness as the most important thing. The discovery of the very purpose of existence and life. To learn what one is, why one lives, and what there is behind all this. This is the first step. To be interested more in the cause and the goal than in the manifestation. Which has put it wonderfully here. You see, this is the manifestation that we are living. But the moment our thought turns to the cause of this manifestation, who is it? What is it? From where is it that we have come? So this is the turn of consciousness. Just the other day I was telling the awakening. The first step of there, something is there, somebody is there. She puts it philosophically. The very first step, turning into yoga, is to be interested more in the cause than in the goal, and the goal than in the manifestation. That is, the first movement is a withdrawal of the consciousness from this total identification with outward and apparent things, and a kind of inward concentration on what one wants to discover, the truth one wants to discover. This is the first movement. So when you are saying that you have the school of yoga, integral yoga, I think these are the things that we can gauge, that if you really want to come into this path or not. You ask yourself. Nobody can judge for you. If you come to Nell and say, I want to join the school, why do you want to join the school? Is it an academic interest? It's not the school in the name because it has a school name. It has to be a group of people who are aspiring for such a life. And then it was only the mother who could have told you, yes, there is this aspiration within you, you can join the ashram. And sometimes she saw this possibility. And she says, a remote possibility, even in the future, that this person admitted to the ashram will open to the divine 30 years hence, 40 years hence. Even with that remote possibility, she would give the person a chance. And many times what has happened is seeing the remote possibility, she has watered the growth of this person. Watered in the sense, she has given extraordinary love, gave him gifts, gave him things, called him, you know, twice a week. I mean, she showered up on that person tremendous grace. But the person's ego never ever changed. On the contrary, In some person, this ego has taken these gifts to be kind of a, the wrong sense. The person interpreted these actions of the mother as if to say, look, I have got a special grace of the mother has descended into me, mother is working in me, I am the mouthpiece of the mother. So this has also happened. So when she gives, we must be careful and take it humbly. When she doesn't give, also be humble. But it is a greater danger when she gives lot more, because there is a tremendous possibility of the ego misusing these gifts of the mother. I mean, I don't want to take names, but these are actual cases that I am referring to. So this is again a thing we must see when we really turn towards this kind of a, what the mother says, the very first movement is draw inwards. So when you come to join the school, as I was telling you, first analyze. Have we got a kind of a withdrawal? Not the ascetic withdrawal. But you know, in my simple words I can say, is there a kind of a disinterestedness in the material things? The simplest word. Let me not say rejection, I don't like, no. But I may have the whole thing, the whole comfort. In fact, once, you know, in those days, early days, I mean, I'm telling you so many stories, I forget the main train. There used to be, I think most of you know here, Champak Lal, right? I mean, he was one of those extraordinary souls who lived, as you must have known, 25 years with Sri Aurobindo, 25 years with Mother. Physically in their presence, serving them. And if I can tell you anything, it's not easier to be with Mother and Sri Aurobindo. I mean, people think, oh, how nice Champak Lal is there upstairs in Sri Aurobindo's room, in the Mother's room. But it's so very difficult. In this sense, you know, not only our mother, not Sri Aurobindo that much, mother was very exacting in her work. I mean, you had to do everything so perfectly, with so much of consciousness, so much of alertness. And especially thanks to Champak Lal, who really secretly collected all the hair and nail from Mother and Sri Aurobindo. Had it not been for him, we wouldn't have the Sri Aurobindo's and Mother's relics. The world would have lost a great thing. But that was the man when Mother used to comb Sri Aurobindo's hair. You know, what a magnificent view must be he has seen. Sri Aurobindo sitting on his sofa, Mother would gently comb his hair. And Mother was so gentle and so careful with Sri Aurobindo. As I was telling this morning to William, that she would herself make the plate for Sri Aurobindo, herself take the plate to him, put it on the table, sit across and eat. She would not allow anyone to make his plate. So that kind of an absolute care and devotion and dedication of the mother to Sri Aurobindo, read Nirodbaran's 2 years with Sri Aurobindo. I mean, it's a remarkable relationship where you see really the Purusha Prakriti, the Ishvara Shakti, you know, that kind of a supremely godlike relations. So this Champak Lal, once, I mean, they used to ask the mother for every little thing, and whatever they got personally from the mother's hand, they would take, otherwise nothing. So once Champak Lal got from someone else, another sadhak, little clock I think, a table clock or something. So he wrote to Sri Aurobindo or asked Sri Aurobindo that, can I keep this or not? So then Sri Aurobindo said, look, material wealth is like this. You should be happy when you have it and not happy when you do not have it. That is the attitude to material wealth. That means I said, oh, this is too much. I should not reject it. I'm happy with it. But tomorrow, if there's lesser than this, or something happens, some people need it and take it away, I should not feel miserable that, oh, yesterday I had a TV and this and this and today I feel miserable. You said, don't be attached. So this is the true asceticism of the inner, not the asceticism of the outer. You don't have to be really minusing everything and say, no, I live only with one table lamp and one glass of water. That is the other extreme of the ascetic world. He said, no. Real asceticism is renunciation from within. What people thought was renunciation from outside. So Gita, and when they said renounce everything, abandon everything, people misread it. So they said, oh, Gita says renounce. But not renounce the world, not renounce the objects. They renounce the desire within. That is the real renunciation. So Sri Aurobindo advised him that if you are not attached to it, fine. But tomorrow somebody takes it away, don't cry over it. So it's coming back to Chambalaji. So I mean, this is the training these people had. You can imagine, I mean, I was very close to Chambalaji, where he used to say, he would sit at the doorstep of Sri Aurobindo's room. He was not inside the room because Sri Aurobindo was alone. Because he said, I was always alert. You never knew when he would call Champaklal. I mean, that kind of a 24 hours alertness, you can imagine what a tremendous strain, human strain. No ordinary person can do that. And he told us, I mean, last 5-6 years, I was extremely close to him. I used to go to him every night, and many nights in the evening. And to go to Sri Aurobindo's room and sit there, that was itself a great blessing. So he would say, Champaklal himself would go for his own bath, his toilet, his eating, only when Sri Aurobindo went to toilet. Not otherwise. So when Sri Aurobindo had to be taken to the bathroom, because you know after the accident Sri Aurobindo needed help. So he put his hand on Champaklal's shoulder, walked slowly to the bathroom. And that time, by the time Sri Aurobindo finished his toilet, he would run down, finish his toilet, have a little bite, and then he would say he never took water much. Till the end of his life he never took water. Not much, just a little sip. Because he said, if I take too much water, I have to go to the toilet. And that would be the 3 minutes I would be missing from Sri Aurobindo's attendance. So imagine, what is dedication? I mean, extreme example of a human dedication. And he would, after Sri Aurobindo and the mother left to bed, which could be 12 o'clock or 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock, you never could tell the time. So that means you have to have complete conquest over sleep, over hunger, over bodily movements. So that kind of a man, I mean, even to imagine, one is on the level of Madan and Sri Aurobindo, what they have done. But the first rung of disciples are supremely exemplary for all mankind. Those of us who say we want to follow, we want to dedicate. And they would get up at 2 o'clock at night because mother's hot water had to be made ready. You know, in those days we didn't have geyser or anything, we had put the boiler, put stick and, you know. And with all this, mother would say, Champaklal, I want that. Yes, mother. So you have to know everything. Shakshosa plus. I mean, you cannot say, look, Mother, I'm searching for it, wait 5 minutes. No question. I want that paper. And Mother would say, I want that card. I want that book. Or I want that pencil. I want this black felt pen. She just said, I want, and instantly he had to give it to her. So he was so meticulous in all his things. And, I think you should postpone my ticket, you know.
Yeah.
I really tell you, you should never call me for a day. I mean, I'm a storyteller, I'm a philosopher, I'm a child of the mother. When I start speaking about them, you know, I forget the paper, I forget. That's my trouble, what to do. One day, I'm greatly enamored of his personality. In fact, I still have a lot of his writings, you know. Because he used to write very slowly, you know. And his English was, to say the least, awful. No grammar, no spellings. He had his own language. I mean, after sitting 5-7 times, you begin to understand the word that he uses. Except for the mother Sri Aurobindo and the mother, no other word almost had the correct spelling. I mean, that kind. Because he never learned his language. Imagine right from day one, he was there under Sri Aurobindo and the mother. So he had no time to do all this. But I really can't imagine humanly how they could do. This gentleman used to sit at nights when Mother Sri Aurobindo had withdrawn. He would take a flower, paint that flower, next morning give it to the mother so that the mother could give the name to that flower. I mean, there was an exhibition after he died. Hundreds of flowers. And what an artist. And what colors. What exactness. Because he had to take this painting to the mother. So they spent night after night, doing this extraordinary, the small little cart like that, doing the flower. And, of course, If he went to his room, he used to have a cupboard like that. In that, again, a cardboard box. In the cardboard box, again, small cardboard boxes again. And which he knew exactly what each cardboard box contained. So one day, he showed the boxes with mother's hair and that. In another one, showed those nails. And he kept with him all the finished pens that the mother had, you know, felt pen get dried up. He won't throw a single thing. And mother, when she sharpened also all the pencil cuttings, I mean, what a consciousness you can imagine. So everything he gathered, and sometimes mother would scold him in the beginning, hey, why are you doing all that? But, you know, he cannot say, answer the mother, and yet somehow not answering the mother, she would keep all that. But one incident I'll tell you, I mean, I've seen that, so I can tell you. He had a great desire in him to get the mother's and show him those footprints. And you know what it means. You can't ask Sri Aurobindo, hey, put your feet on the paper, I want to draw. I mean, it's such an impossible thing. And yet he said, no, I have to do it. I want to do it. So, he waited, he watched every step, when there is a minute's pause when Sri Aurobindo would put his foot down. You know, the whole study he made. And so one day, I mean, when Sri Aurobindo would get up for his bathroom, he would sit on the bed and then his foot would come down. So he watched everything and then one day he put the paper down. So the moment he put his foot down, maybe Sri Aurobindo was adjusting his dress or his dhoti or something, immediately he took 1 foot. So that day's job was done. And without telling anything, I mean, they cannot disturb Sri Aurobindo by even a degree of discomfort. So that is the ultimate devotion, you see. So even, you can say, hey, what are you doing? Or something is pricking my foot. Why am I being, asked to wait? When you can see the devotee's extreme devotion when the Lord cannot be disturbed. I mean, I'm, am charmed by this kind of an absolute, you know, dedication. So, he took one foot one day, and then after several days passed away, then another foot came, he drew that. And of course, it was a bit easier with the mother. You know, mother was mother, really. I mean, you go say, mother, I want your footprints, and mother will nicely kiss, and then you do it.